The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion on current affairs in China, coming to you from Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. This week, critical media, foreign and domestic. We'll be looking at these two aspects of media coverage in China. First, we'll talk about a perennial topic that comes up in conversations about the media, the question of bias in foreign media coverage of China, and specifically Western or Anglophone media coverage. Then, lest anyone conclude that it's only the foreign media writing critically about aspects of China, we'll be looking at the state of investigative reporting in China. I'm delighted to have Tanya Branigan from The Guardian back with us. Tanya, earlier this week, The Guardian published a terrific piece of yours about China's best-known investigative journalist, Wang Keqin. We look forward to hearing more about that story.
He's a pretty amazing guy.
We're also joined by Jeremy Goldcorn from Danway.org. And we welcome back Bill Bishop, the blogger behind Digicha.com and Sinicism.com, who also tweets like a madman under the handle Newbie, N-I-U-B-I.
Nice to be back.
Let's jump right in and start talking about foreign media bias, or specifically Western media bias. This is something that, as I suggested, comes up perennially in conversation. It's not always something that I enjoy talking about. It's actually, I find it very difficult. There are a lot of caveats I need to lay out before I can actually jump into a conversation. Personally, I guess I know an awful lot of journalists here, and my judgment of their work is generally very, very positive. I don't think that there's a lot of inherent bias. At the same time, something happens along the way, along the editorial process, that often leads me to tear my hair out in anguish. Is the Western media biased in its coverage? Jeremy?
Put me on the spot there. Sometimes I think it is biased. I personally think the biggest problem is that many stories about China are framed in a certain way by editorial offices at home, where the editors may be much less informed about China than the correspondent on the ground. So both in terms of topic selection, deciding which stories will be published or which stories will get prominent position in a paper or on a website, and in terms of headline writing, you do see, I think, quite clearly biases originating in New York and London editorial offices that do affect the stories written here. I do think there are some correspondents who tend to turn out more biased stories or have more preconceived opinions than others, but I don't think the Western media as a whole is biased against China by any means.
Tanya, would you agree with that?
Well, I think Jeremy makes a really good point, which is that usually when I see things that do make me tear my hair out, they're not things that are from correspondents who are based here. It's almost always a caption or a headline. And most of the mistakes that people have highlighted in coverage, really glaring mistakes, are mistakes that are made by people working outside China. And that's not something that's unique to China either, though. I mean, there are often, journalism is fast moving, you're producing what they call the first draft of history. You know, you have a few hours to produce a piece very often on a subject that people may not know much about. You're trying to get things out very quickly, particularly now with websites, the speed with which you're trying to get information out is much faster. And so there is more scope for mistakes. Do those mistakes sometimes reflect an underlying bias or a particular way of viewing the situation? Yes, but as I said, that's not unique to China.
Tanya, you hit on something interesting there that I think not everyone knows, which is that captions are not written by the photographer necessarily, that headlines, subheads are not written by the actual reporters. And often that's where you find, I mean, because of the exigencies of space, you find sort of the most absurd reduction and often, you know, glaring bias in headlines and in subhead writing.
Yeah, absolutely. And even sometimes within pieces, it varies from place to place. In general, The Guardian doesn't take a massively interventionist approach to subbing or changing our copy once we've filed it. But there are quite a lot of newspapers where the job of subs is to essentially rewrite what reporters put in. And so, again, that introduces a lot of scope for mistakes and for misunderstandings, I think.
When we write about China, irrespective of whether you're an academic or a blogger or a journalist, we tend to write things often in accordance with an existing narrative. Or when we go off the rails, when we sort of go off the true sort of center path, we roll very easily into these well-worn ruts. You can think of it in terms of sort of a wagon wheel that leaves a deep rut in the road, and the easiest place to often travel is in that well-worn narrative. What are some of these narratives that we encounter frequently? Some of the ways that people frame China-related issues that lead to bias? Bill, you want to take a shot?
Well, first of all, everybody has bias, and you know, not just the media, but I think the U.S. media has bias about U.S. issues, right? So we're in China, so we're talking about China-specific stuff, but I think we should all remember that inherently there's bias in everybody's coverage.
Absolutely.
I think one example of exactly what we were just talking about was incident that happened, I think, in January or February, where some artists were beaten by a group of thugs in a village outside Beijing. And then they were led, some of them were led on a protest by Ai Weiwei, led onto Changjie. And I was actually watching the protest on Twitter as Ai Weiwei and a couple of people were tweeting away the whole protest, and saw the pictures, and then the police broke it up. And Ai Weiwei said, he actually said the police were quite reasonable and we left and everything was fine. The New York Times wrote an article, one of their very good correspondents here who understands China. The article, though, when it went online, the headline was Beijing police beat artists.
Right.
Which absolutely didn't happen. And the people there knew it didn't happen, but somebody in New York or wherever the editing desk was just decided that it's back to your question about what are some of the stories. One of the overarching memes is China's a police state. The police beat everybody they want. And so therefore, that's a frame of reference for a lot of people here. And yes, there are lots of security services here, but it's not as much of a totalitarian police state as I think a lot of Western media or Western audiences think it is.
So that's one of them, certainly, China as police state. What are some of the others that we frequently encounter in reporting on China?
The latest one is China is going to collapse. The China economy is going to collapse. It's very interesting, and I've actually been writing on my blog in some ways because I like writing against what the current meme is. The current meme in the business and financing reporting in the West is the bear case.
The
treadmill to hell, or China is going to collapse, or China is the greatest bubble in history.
Dubai times 1,000.
Exactly. And yes, there are lots of issues in the economy, but what you're seeing in the Western media and watching is you're seeing lots of people who are either on TV or in the print actually don't understand the story, but they're quoting all the same people. And so you get this crazy echo chamber that just sort of bounces back and forth and reinforces this idea that it's this treadmill to hell, greatest bubble in history.
But on the other hand, at the same time right now, you also have another narrative, which is the China has the answer to the world.
Beijing consensus.
I think, shouted down over the last 3 months by this bear narrative. It's sort of the next wave. Is now it's going to collapse.
Right. Well, the two of them actually talk to different audiences. There's sort of the economic collapse narrative. Which is a little more wonkish, and you know, there are a lot of people in the investment community that pay a lot of attention to that. But I'm talking more in the sort of general media. But this is out there, certainly, but it's not I think there's a lot of life still to this Beijing consensus narrative, this idea that there is this new sort of authoritarian model, developmental model, that will in some sense compete with the United States and the last man, you know, the liberal democratic model in liberal democratic capitalism in the 21st century. There's a new book actually out called The Beijing Consensus, playing on this term that was coined by Josh Cooper Ramos. Jeremy, what are some of the other narratives that we hear out there?
Well, I mean, the police state one has a number of sub-narratives. You know, it's police beat artists, police beat Tibetans, police cut up Falun Gong members and use their organs for transplants. I think that one is pretty rich. There are quite a few narratives.
Right.
Much in the mainstream media, actually.
Yeah, that's true, actually. At least the cutting up the Falun Gong people, you don't see that much.
Well, in the Epoch Times, you see it all the time. Right?
And actually, I mean, another interesting point that I've realized is that quite often what people think journalists have written and what they actually have written are quite different things. It's not just about the headline and the captions, but it's actually about the expectations that readers bring to a piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is something that you really can't control. And so you have quite strange conversations with readers sometimes when they say, you know, you said this or that. And you say, well, actually, you know, go back, read this paragraph. You know, we make it clear that this didn't happen. And yet there's this sort of strange assumption in people's minds. They think they know what the story is, and they interpret what you actually write in the light of that.
Let's go back to the year 2008 in March, the uprising that happened, the riots in Lhasa, and that spread to other cities in Western China, not just in the Tibetan Autonomous Region. That was sort of the moment of birth of anti-CNN. That was probably when this discussion around media bias really first erupted. I think that a lot of the narratives that we're dealing with, a lot of the framing, does surround the relationship between China and its minorities. We saw the following year in June of 2009.
That one, sorry, just go back your framing sure. question. I think that's one you should mention, is the nasty communists and peaceful
Tibetans. Of course.
And the underlying idea that actually Tibet's only oppressed because communists want it, but if China were a democracy, the Chinese people would let it go free.
Wrong.
Yes, yeah. But that seems to be a very widely held belief in the West.
Right. I mean, there are a million of them. There's the old sweatshop narrative, right? We hear this one all the time.
Some are true.
But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a basis for – I mean, who would argue that China is completely free of any semblance of police state, you know? I mean, maybe it's more rent-a-cop state, but –
I think obviously the thing as a journalist is there is we have no interest, or I hope we have no interest. No reputable journalist, let's put it that way, has an interest in writing things that aren't true. So there are sort of two issues, which are one, why do you select the stories you do? And when you come to any news, as you say, there's a bias, there's a way you frame things, whether it be domestic or international. The particular problem, I think, with international news is that your primary audience at home probably don't have the same knowledge and background understanding of the country that they do of the place that they themselves live in. The other question is why you get the kind of mistakes we talked about, where people sort of have a headline like Beijing police beat artists and it's not true. Again, it's an issue sort of framing.
When we make mistakes, we fall into the familiar rut. I mean, that's what seems to happen.
But I think Tanya's point is that, there's some truth in those ruts. I mean, if China did not have a lot of police and Chengguan who beat people up
right,
the whole time,
then that wouldn't exist.
They weren't oppressing
reaction would have been, oh,
I mean,
yeah. Right. But it's also exacerbated by real structural issues in Western media, specifically around financial situations and how, I mean, you probably don't want to speak to The Guardian, but most American publications are
sucking
being
wind.
Gutted.
Yes,
and
yes.
So everybody is understaffed and overworked. The New York Times, you talk to people in the U.S. in the media business, the New York Times is notorious for having editorial problems for years now. So the fact that they made this one mistake around, you know, the artists was maybe not even China specific, but just a more of a symptom of a broader problem within their whole editorial process.
Absolutely. I mean, all media organizations are under more pressure. We're producing more. We're producing it
with
more
less.
Quickly, and we're producing it with less.
Yeah.
So
let's go back to 08, as I suggested earlier, to March of 08, when a lot of this sort of emerged for the first time. Did the anti-CNN guys have a point? There were a couple of major problems that had happened. One of them was the misidentification in some CNN footage, I think it was, of Nepalese police as Chinese, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was a problem with some photo captions. There was a problem with
cropping
of photos in a Reuters photo of rioters in Lhasa, where they had left out, you know, knife-wielding, violent-looking Tibetans and focused instead on someone who – I don't remember the specifics of it. This happened again the following year. I remember, Bill, we had talked about this. There was a photo of a hatchet-faced PLA some uniformed Chinese man standing in the museum of Surf Liberation, I believe it was. I can't say that without chuckling a bit. He was standing behind in front of a display of weapons where it was quite clearly labeled that these were used by the Tibetans in the uprising, and it had been mislabeled as weapons that were used in the suppression of the riots.
Again, by either a photo editor or by the photographer himself or herself. Right.
Right. So how do we explain this to our Chinese friends? How do we explain what's happening here and exculpate?
Well, I mean, you know, specifically in the case of Tibet, I mean, Tibet's not the subject of this podcast, but I think from a – you know, as we were just talking, the media is overworked. The Chinese government does not make it easy to access stories. And whereas I think you find that the Tibetan, you know, information infrastructure is much more Western media friendly. And so they do a much better job of getting out their stories in Western media. And they're much more sympathetic. And so I think you tell me, but I mean, you can probably talk to anyone from – sorry?
That's true, but I think people also treat what they say with caution. I mean, you don't find press releases just being sort of reproduced.
Depends on the paper.
Well, it does depend on the paper. I mean, you know, I remember a journalism student sort of saying to me, is your job to regard the Chinese government cynically? And I said, no, my job is to regard everybody I speak to skeptically.
Right.
Because,
right.
You know, your job is to try and hold it up to an
analysis. Everybody's spinning something.
But as you say, I mean, the essential point is that some people make it much easier for you to have access to, some people are much keener to explain their viewpoint. And one problem is that because the Chinese government kept people from going or did their best to keep people out of any of the areas where there was unrest in 2008 and were turning people back, I think people thought, well, why aren't you letting us in? You know, it wasn't the Tibetans who were keeping us out of those areas. I had a colleague who spent a week driving around trying to find out what was happening. And I think if the government was more willing to let people in, the coverage would be better. And I think that's something that they're probably aware of, because if you look at what happened in Urumqi last
year,
it was very different. We were able to go in and able to
investigate. The Urumqi coverage was, I mean, partially I think it's the Uyghurs are, for lots of reasons, maybe less sympathetic than Tibetans, but also...
As they say, they're camels while the Tibetans are pandas.
But they're also not nearly as well organized overseas as the Tibetan groups are. And again, what you were saying, where they gave access. I mean, the coverage of what happened in Urumqi seemed to be much more balanced than what had happened in Tibet.
Well, I think, you know, the baby boomers who are currently in charge of editorial policy at pretty much every major British and American news organization have a lot more fondness for Buddhism. I think that's...
Than Islam.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a bias in the West. Westerners, educated Westerners, Buddhism is stuff white people like. Educated Westerners, they like Buddhism. which, I mean, I think is pretty ridiculous when you see Tibetans kind of kneeling, prostrating themselves for 2,000 miles from Qinghai to Lhasa. I have a big problem with that. But it is nonetheless, I mean, that I think is a very clear bias. It's not only in China or Tibet, but...
Back to Tanya's point, though, about the role of journalism. I mean, how there apparently seemed to be this sort of disconnect. Journalism student asking you to sort of clarify. I saw an editorial some time ago in the Global Times. There was a columnist named Zhan Jiang, who wrote, "Western journalism has a deep distrust of governments and tends to view them negatively. This is in stark contrast to the Chinese media, which is largely in harmony with government. In addition, Western journalism, rooted in a distinct sense of justice, favors minorities and the disadvantaged." Do you think that – I mean, there's something
that's not
that?
True at all anymore in the U.S. That is just not accurate. Look at the press. Look at the,
you think
look
it's
the
been
major
whole,
mainstream
utterly
the Iraq
media.
War is the classic
The Iraq
example.
War is the classic.
Sure.
If you want to talk about – why aren't they writing about all the underprivileged children that live three blocks from the White House? Why aren't they on the front page of the Washington Post every day?
At the same time,
mainstream
you
US
they
media
haven't been
could
co-opted
care less at this
when
point.
It comes to the China story, though.
Right, but the I mean, the U.S. media is so captured by the government at this point. Access. I mean, we were just talking about Steve Clemens. He had a great piece. It's been talked about in the U.S. This real problem of these White House correspondents who, the Bob Woodward problem. They will not write critical pieces because they lose access, and they all have 6- or 7-figure book deals to write about the White House.
Right.
So it can be completely captured by the system.
It's the subject of last week's podcast. If you haven't heard it.
I think one of the sort of the classic issues that comes up, because very often when I speak to Chinese people, they ask me about the bias of the Western media.
Sure.
And actually, one of the reassuring things is that usually you can have quite a good conversation, even if people are initially quite hostile, when you sort of talk to them about pressures. I mean, I think there's a sort of assumption that the Western media are monolithic, which of course is one of the great sort of myths about the Chinese government that people
That's
always
right,
sort
monolithic.
Of quote. But in the same way, you know, the Western media is not a monolith.
When I talk about the Western media, I can't help but put air quotes around it because I bristle at that whole, you know, idea that there's some sort of monolithic Western media.
It's not a joke, though. I mean, if you look at, you know, I know you did a podcast on soft power a few weeks ago, and it ties into this idea that they launched the overseas TV network. And I mean, there are specific government bodies that are, you know, looking at how to build an international media presence to put a voice to China in the rest of the world. But if you read some of the stuff that's been in, I think it was in Seeking Truth, some of the theoretical journals, they actually talk about this sort of the domination of the Western media. So not just individuals from a core ideological perspective, the party clearly thinks that it is this monolithic, hostile force against China.
Someone made an interesting point. I don't know how true this is, but they suggested, you know, if you're used to doing kind of Marxist structural analyses of things, then you see the Western
media. Back to biases,
being,
back to how you frame problems. Exactly, this is their worldview. This is how they look at the world.
It's representing capitalist interests.
Right.
I mean, but, you know, there's this assumption that in quite a sort of crude way that the Western media is somehow there to represent Western governments or Western capitalist interests. There are a lot of unfair things I read about China, but, you know, I'm not going to apologize for the fact that we cover human rights, because that's exactly what we should be doing.
Absolutely.
And, that's what your audience wants too.
Exactly. But, you know, we've also written a lot on Guantanamo Bay. We've written on extraordinary rendition. And I think the thing that sometimes particularly Chinese readers don't notice, maybe because they're mostly reading what we write on China, is, you know, if Western governments are sometimes hypocritical in talking about human rights while they act in another way, that doesn't necessarily mean that the media is.
Right. But in the U.S., I mean, Glenn Greenwald, who writes at Salon, he's a very good media critic, and he's pointed out repeatedly, he talks a lot about the biases in Western media, specifically about things like Guantanamo Bay. I mean, if you step back as a Martian who showed up in America, which country in the last 8 years has killed tens of thousands of innocent civilians?
Right.
Which country, as a sort of a different world observer, would you say actually has a worse human rights record?
Right? Let's not get into that.
No, but honestly, so the Western media won't talk about that, by and large. In the U.S., you won't see that in the U.S. press. Right, so when you talk about biases, I mean they're biases across the board, and I think it's hard. We all have our own set of interests, so it's obviously difficult. And I don't want to get lots of hate mail, so I'm just saying if you're interested in this topic, you should read Glenn Greenwald at Salon. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting perspective.
Absolutely,
it's a very dissident perspective.
A couple of weeks ago, in a podcast that you hosted, when we talked about the attacks on children, the knife attacks on children in Chinese schools, Will Moss had an interesting phrase that he used to talk about how when we tend to go from a very specific example and to generalize it. He had a groovy sort of PR catchphrase for it, in effect. But that's the case in Chinese reporting or in reporting on China. There's a tendency when you're reading about a foreign country and you read a particular phenomenon to see that as the norm. Leslie Chang, who is the author of Factory Girls and a former reporter for a number of years at the Wall Street Journal here in Beijing and also in Shanghai, was quoted recently in an interview about the question of media bias. She says, if you write a story about a homeless man who's living in his car or a family that's working three jobs and their kids are still hungry, people will understand that not everyone in America is in these dire conditions. She's talking about America, of course. But these are important issues that we need to focus on and that people can actually change things because of this information. But when you're writing about China and you write these quite sensational or unrepresentative stories about migrants losing their arms in terrible factory accidents or someone's child dying because of pollution in the river, those cases obviously happen. But I think here in America, people read them and think, oh my gosh, this is horrible. They can't help but think that this is what is happening all the time in China because they don't realize that most people are very poor by our American standards. But their lives are improving and they're often quite optimistic about their future because their context is where they're coming from and not where America is now.
Do you know what year she wrote that?
Just last year.
Okay.
Or early this year. But to her point, I think that we do face this problem, right? I mean, it's the same here. I've met innumerable Chinese who take one media report about something that's happened in America and just assume that it's commonplace, right? We all tend to do this naturally. Not much to say on that? I mean, is it just painfully obvious to you or?
Well, I think the context is a very big problem of foreign correspondence. That's always the problem, is that people at your audience, your readers back home, don't have the context of daily life to modify it. What's different about America and, to an extent, England is that we all know about American England because we all watch American TV shows and films. I mean, this is everywhere. Even in Saudi Arabia, people watch American TV shows. British culture, thanks to several hundred years of colonialism and the English language, is also as well known. It's a known entity. So even if you don't know much about America or England, you probably know enough to assume that when you read a report about a homeless man, that's not representative of the whole country because you've seen Hollywood movies with people in Ferraris and you've seen, you know, TV shows with British people drinking tea and...
Whereas China is opaque, right?
No, but China, I think that's why I was asking what year she wrote it, because I think after, you know, the Olympics and now the Shanghai Expo and then the financial crisis, I think the narrative about China has shifted. And I think most, or certainly a fair number of people in the West would now think of China as actually the people with the money now.
Right. I mean, that Pew study and that I think said that 44% that, of Americans think that that China is the leading economic power.
Right. And I think that has – the financial crisis accelerated that shift in perceptions, I think, by several years.
Tani, do you think that that's the case back in your audiences back home? Do you see a shift?
I think certainly views are starting to change. I mean, I think one problem maybe when you talk about bias is that, you know, most places have a biased take when they're looking at someone else. But in the context of the West, you're talking about kind of quite a specific power relationship that has existed for a long time. You're talking about the fact that, you know, the UK had a vast empire for a very long time. And I think for a lot of people in the West, there has been a sort of a narrative of looking at other countries and saying, when are they going to develop? Essentially of seeing other countries as being backwards and needing to develop and become like us, which I think is a kind of pretty terrible way of understanding large parts of the world. And so the danger, I guess, is when people have partial understandings of things and it fits into that sort of broader narrative. I mean, you know, I think good reporting requires nuance. And so one of the things we write news, we write what's new and we write what's interesting and what's striking. And we're not going to suddenly start writing about, you know, 10 million people poddling about their daily lives, drinking tea and being perfect.
Nor are you going to provide a history lesson,
right?
That's for bloggers, indeed.
But nor are you going to provide a history lesson every time, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to lay out the context of every story.
Exactly. We have limited space. So I'm not going to sort of provide 1,000 words of background detail. But on the other hand, sometimes you can kind of stick in an extra line or two that says, you know, this is what proportion of this affects. Or writing about the school stabbings the other week, you know, talking about people talking about rising inequality in China. Well, I think it's quite useful to say, actually, inequality in China is roughly similar to inequality in the States.
Yeah, that's
it helps people understand it.
Well, I think you made a great point. I think there's, and I don't have any data to back it up, but my intuitive sense is that you're seeing a rapid shift in the narrative in the West where, to your point about, well, everyone else is backward because, you know, we're America, we're Britain. All of a sudden, people are very stressed out in the U.S. and in England and Europe about the financial crisis, jobs, unemployment. Very quickly, the narrative shifted to, oh, my God, these guys are going to be richer than us. You know, all of a sudden, you know, there's fear. We're going to be overtaken.
And the other curious thing is that very often when people talk about, you know, the bias of the Western media, it goes back to this idea that China is somehow under attack from the rest of the world, that it's this sort of poor, defenseless country that needs to stand up for itself and that it's David. Well, quite large parts of the world are starting to see it as Goliath.
Right.
Equally inaccurately, in my view. But there's a sort of, that's partly why this idea, or that's partly why this kind of hostility to Western criticism is there, I think, which is this sense of being under siege.
Well, I hope, you know, we have more correspondents like Tanya, and also as more and more of these, you know, papers go away on newsprint and actually go online, I hope that media organizations actually will be more creative in how they use space online. Not maybe you write, but you're able to link to, point to stuff that gives you much more background. And I think most media organizations have yet to fully exploit or take advantage of those opportunities to help educate their audiences.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Western media aren't the only people in town who are writing critical stories about what's happening in China today. There's a whole cottage industry, hopefully, that's really evolving of true investigative journalists. Tanya had a terrific piece called Wang Keqin and China's Revolution in Investigative Journalism. We're all familiar with Hu Shuli, who was the editor of Caijing and has now moved on to another publication, Caixin. So let's shift the conversation now and talk about what's going on domestically in China with investigative journalism. Tanya, just for our readers who might not be familiar with who Wang Keqin is, why don't you give us a little bit of background on this guy and the publication he writes for?
Well, he's probably China's best-known investigative journalist. He's been in the trade for a long, long time. Oddly enough, he started out as an official, and he told me he actually got into journalism because it allowed him to earn a bit of money on the side. And at that point, for cobbling together one article, he could go and buy about 15 bowlfuls of beef noodles. So it was quite a sort of handy sideline for him to have. But gradually, as he began writing these pieces, people started to come to him with their problems. And he found he was just interested, touched by what they had to say. He felt he had a responsibility to try and share what they were saying with him. And so he began to do what he calls real journalism as opposed to fake journalism, and to tell those stories. And over time, he's produced a kind of string of fairly amazing scoops at quite a cost to himself.
What were some of the stories that really put him on the map as an investigative journalist?
Well, the stories that put him on the map and also made him known as China's most expensive journalist, which is not a reference to his expenses claim, but to the price that was put on his head, is back in 2001, he did a big expose of illegal dealings in local financial markets. And that enraged the gangs in the area in Gansu so much that they put a very, very hefty price tag on his head. It wasn't the first death threat he'd received by any means, but as you can imagine, that was pretty terrifying for both him and his family. And then to compound that, he managed to write another story which upset the local officials. And so he found he was in trouble with them too.
I'm surprised that actually he hasn't been written about too often in the Western press. Has there been a lot of reportage about him?
No, but I mean, this kind of thing always takes a long time. I was just looking yesterday at on our website, Dangwei, coverage of Han Han and Ai Weiwei. We've been writing about these guys since 2004, about what are their blogging and online activities and this kind of thing. It's only in the last year that suddenly they hit the most influential list and this. These things take time. Chinese people's names are very difficult to remember. I think if he carries on doing it, it's likely that he will become better known.
And recently, of course, he was in the news for his expose in the China Economic Times, right? For his reports on the vaccination scandal, which we've talked about before, the vaccination scandal in Shanxi Province. Did he give you a lot of background about that whole affair?
No, I mean, he's said that he didn't really want to talk about that when we contacted him. The initial interview I did was actually before that controversy broke out, and so we tried to speak to him again. He said he'd not in a position to comment on that one for the simple reason that, as you may know, the story came out linking vaccines to the sickness and deaths of some children. Officials then popped up and said, well, we've looked into it all and it's all fine and there's really not an issue. And then, surprise, surprise, a few weeks later, we discover that his editor has been removed
right.
And shunted off to a sort of fairly minor sister company.
And what about he himself, though? I mean, he's his editor obviously has responsibility for what they run, but has Wang run into any kind of trouble, sort of censorship?
Well, I mean, he said to me, there are some stories you can't report.
Right.
And I think we all know that. But the other point he makes, and this is one of the reasons that I think he's become a role model to a lot of young journalists, he says, you have to get it right, you know. There are a lot of things you can do, but you've got to be precise. You've got to make sure that all your facts are nailed down.
Give us a sense for how investigative journalism has evolved over the last 10 or 15 years here in China.
I think one of the things that's probably really driven it has been the commercialization of the press, which mm-hmm. has created a real sort of incentive to sort of go out there and get scoops and get interesting stories. And also the fact that people are used to more personal freedom. They're used to being able to talk about issues more critically. They've also, a lot of the younger journalists have grown up with role models such as Wang. So there's a sort of sense of that this is possible. Tempering that, of course, there's also the other side with the commercial pressures you now see, which is that, you know, do you want to spend a lot of money on a story that maybe won't see the light of day in the end, which is a point somebody made to me. You know, and that's a problem as well, actually, for Western media now that you know, fewer Western papers have investigative teams because it costs money and time and resources. So if you then think you're going to come up with something which maybe you won't be able to publish, you know, it's quite hard to persuade an editor that that's going to be worth doing.
Well, and even if you do publish it, if you piss off the wrong people or company, you tend to lose advertising dollars.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
I think it's even more, well, it's explicit in the West, it's explicit here too.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there are sort of real, you know, there are commercial pressures to offset that commercial advantage you can get from a great story.
Wang Keqin certainly is not alone in China as an investigative reporter or as somebody who's willing to take on more sensitive and potentially very kind of dangerous stories. I think probably the most noteworthy journalist out there, who's an editor, is Hu Shuli. Bill, you're really familiar with Cai Jing. I know you're a real avid fan of her work at Cai Jing and now at Caixin. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she's been the subject of long profiles in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and probably several other Western papers. So, I mean, she's probably pretty well known to the audience. She's very impressive. She built up Cai Jing magazine into what was really the preeminent sort of financial. Started out really as a business financial publication, but really started covering very aggressively, covering right up to the edge of what was reportable in China, both in terms of not in social as well as political stories. Had some sort of falling out last summer and set up a new company called Caixin, still in Beijing, took most of her same team, and so has a new magazine that's, I think it's called New Century Weekly is actually the official title.
That's right.
And they, you know, they write very important stuff. You know, I like it because in many ways it's like financial porn. I mean, if you want to know how corruption works in China, read Caixin or read Caixin, because they will give you great stories about sort of what really happens. This latest issue of Caixin has of the New Century Weekly has a very interesting story about the details behind Gomez Huang Guangyu's case.
Huang Guangyu, yeah, also who we've talked about on the podcast. Yeah. Jeremy, who are some of your heroes in investigative journalism in China?
I don't know if I have any heroes. I mean, I think Li Datong is one other person that should be mentioned.
He was the editor of Bingdian.
Of Bingdian.
Freezing
and
Point.
Has been, you know, writing hard-hitting pieces for many years and continues to do it, even though he doesn't have much of a presence anymore in the mainland media. I think if you cover the three of those are probably the best known of China's journalists. But I mean, sometimes one also has to look at the publications. Nanfang Zhoumo and the Southern Group generally, Southern
Good
Weekly,
stuff.
Have
yeah, very much.
For years. And, you know, and some people define the sort of sort of watershed moment, Sun Zhigang case, the graphic designer who was beaten to death by police in
Guangzhou in 2003. And really sort of single-handedly brought down the hukou system as it used to be.
Yeah, one could say that. And that one could attribute to a group of editors, I think, at the Southern Weekly. And the Southern Weekly is, of course, a very interesting beast because it's owned by the government, the provincial government. But it has managed, despite many, many purges, to continue publishing stuff that other newspapers just won't touch.
Bill, there's a real geographic difference, right? I mean, when you move south, well, Shanghai, of course, is notoriously timid in its reporting. When you get down to Guangzhou with the whole Southern Group, I mean, there is some really amazing stuff that's coming out of there. I mean, it's really quite hard hitting. What explains this? Is it just simply that the heaven is high and the emperor is far away when you're that far south?
I'm not sure. I think that's part of it. But if you look at Hu Shuli, she's in Beijing, right?
Yes.
So they, you know, I think it depends on who really is your backer in the government. And for, I guess, Guangdong province must, you know, whoever's working or whoever's really behind the Southern Weekend must be fairly willing to support them in any problems they may have with the sort of central ministry propaganda.
And also, I mean, Hu Shuli has been a mistress of this, I guess, which is judging the time to do a story and judging how you write and frame a story, because it's a lot of the lines are not sort of red lines, but grey lines. And if you can find the right way to approach right. it, and if you have the right backers, and if somebody has perhaps said something which makes you think you can flag an issue up, then you probably have a certain space to do that. But I do say probably, because obviously people do sometimes misjudge it.
And they made mistakes at Caixin. They had more than one issue was actually pulled after it was on the newsstand, where they misjudged what was reportable.
Yeah, it's a very difficult line to assess often, even if you're an old news veteran like Hu Shuli is. But there are problems that you talk about in the world of journalism in China. Toward the end of your story, you talk about this business of fake journalists, of the bribery and blackmail, and that goes on quite routinely here. We had this gigantic scandal around coal mines, around fake reporters showing up at coal mines. I think that was the middle of last year. What ails Chinese journalism? Jeremy, do you want to take a...
Oh, so many things ail Chinese journalism. I think we could speak for another 5 hours about it. But there, on the one hand, commercial pressures, as Tanya pointed out, have contributed to liberalizing in some ways the Chinese press because people want more interesting stories. But on the other hand, there's pressure from advertisers. So you have, you know, journalists have to be careful. They can't piss off their publication's main advertisers. You have the Hongbao culture, where it is standard in Chinese journalism to get a so-called transport fee of usually about 200 kuai, sometimes 300.
300 is the rate.
From press conferences where companies or, you know, sometimes even apparently government organizations will encourage people to come to a press conference and they get this.
And they sort of give you the story ahead of time, print it out just for you to transcribe.
Basically copy and paste, yeah. You know, there is obviously a very strict censorship regime. There's a very big element of self-censorship, which sort of goes from the reporter themselves, what they decide to write, right up to the editor-in-chief, what they decide to publish. there's the fact that this is an industry that everybody knows has grown out of the propaganda industry. So they're not really role models that have been around very long, because 30 years ago there was no such thing as journalism in China.
And yet clearly some of the publications that we've been talking about have been able to really inculcate a good sort of ethics, an atmosphere of better ethics in journalism. How are they doing that? Is it just a matter of paying them more, or selection of journalists?
No, it's people. I mean, right. the people who've done it. I think Hu Shuli is a great example of somebody who's been willing to, you know, make difficult decisions in order to sustain a certain culture.
Although she also did talk about the importance of wages.
They pay better.
Yeah.
And they're banned from taking any sort of gifts or money. If they do, they get fired.
Tell me, what is it like economically for a Chinese journalist? What kind of money, just for our listeners who aren't familiar with it and don't have friends who are writers, how bad is it? What is your average sort of cub journalist just out of J school, who's writing for, your Beijing Wanbao or what have you?
If you're a famous writer for a newspaper kind of, you can get 千字, 千元, 1,000 kuai for 1,000 characters. So 1,000 characters can translate into, say, 1,500, 200-word English story. Mm-hmm. You would get, as a freelancer, as a famous freelancer, you'd get...
$140.
Yeah, for that. And it gets worse. You know, if you're not famous, you might not even make 100 kuai for a story. The wages are a couple of thousand a month. But, I mean, they can go up once you reach the senior editorial ranks, but as a pounding the pavement journalist, you're looking at a few thousand RMB, as far as I know.
I think one of the other things that has made a difference has been, as you say, individuals. And again, I mean, Wang's been kind of training up these younger journalists, and that's something his sort of newspapers tasked him with. I have to say, very, very high standards, which a lot of Western papers would do well to emulate. I mean, he insists, I think, that for every story you have to have 6 independent witnesses. That's not experts and so forth, but people who have direct involvement. They have to be fully identified to him, although obviously not necessarily in the pieces he publishes. He demands phone numbers so he can ring them up and check, and he insists on having at least 10 substantive quotes from each interviewee. So, I mean, there's this whole kind of structure that he's trying to introduce, and a whole sort of set of standards.
Has he, to your knowledge, gotten any formal training in journalism in the West, or is he a homegrown guy?
That's a very good question. As far as I know, he is homegrown.
It's possible, just judging from Wang, that you can develop that on your own here domestically.
Well, and I think Jeremy sort of talks about the structural issues, which are obviously huge and very important. But equally, as Bill was saying earlier, you know, there are some pretty terrible journalists in the West. And within any industry, you're going to get a real... Yeah. range of ability, and that's exactly what you see in China.
I'm surprised the White House hasn't considered the Hongbao transportation fee model for the press pool. I mean, they do it. They actually do it by access and giving you access to write a book if you write nice stuff. Right? You piss off the White House, you lose your access.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And you lose your access, you lose your ability to make money. So they're not actually giving you cash up front, but is it really that different?
Yeah, and, you know, in the West, you will get these kind of jolly trips where people say, someone offered me a trip sort of going yachting in Hong Kong the other week, and I said no thank you because I didn't really think there was a story in it. But you know, is that really any different from the Hongbao? I don't think so.
No, it's
but
not.
It's not, but it,
it's,
but
it's cleaner, it's more refined,
but it's not
theoretically,
but I would say, you know, it's not part of the industry in a way it is in China. It's not standard, and it's not right.
It's just sort of accepted
it's
practice.
Just endemic. Yeah, well, yeah.
Tani, in your piece you mentioned a rule that was put into place in 2004 that regulates the ability of journalists to write about areas that aren't under their sort of explicit domain. Tell me how that's impacted investigative journalism here.
Well, a lot of people really feel that that sort of ended the golden era for investigative journalism because it made it much harder to go out and do these sorts of stories. And obviously many journalists basically ignore the rule and do go and do great reporting anyway. But it means that officials can impede them and do impede them. And it also means that very often they face repercussions afterwards.
So the rule really is invoked from time to time?
It's there. Let's put it this way. David Bandersky, who's a scholar at the China Media Project, said to me, well, I've never actually seen a copy of it, but many, many people have told me that it exists.
Bill, the other day Roland Song from Dongnan Xibei.
ZonaEuropa.com.
Yeah, ZonaEuropa.com.
We'll link to it on the podcast introduction.
Sure. he had an interesting piece that you were you tweeted out. Tell us about that, about this.
Well, Xinhua, the official state news service, actually has a two-tiered system for news, right? There's the news that's released publicly, but then there's a much richer and much more extensive set of coverage that goes to China's leaders. And I think actually the Xinhua reporters do good reporting and good coverage of lots of stuff that never sees the light of day. And so Roland Song obtained a copy of a presentation that a Xinhua editor had given at a journalism school, where he talked about stories like the problems in Urumqi last July and like the return to Earth of the first astronaut, Yang Liwei, mm-hmm. and where what actually happened was, and what was told to the leaders in China was very different than actually what was reported publicly. And so when we talk about investigative journalism, you know, a lot of us, most of us actually have no idea what is really, you know, I think the people in power in China may actually know a lot more about some of these problems and what happens than we give them credit for. Because I think there's this much richer, deeper Xinhua system that reports a lot of stuff.
Mm. According to that story, Yang Liwei actually on his return, on his descent, he was under some enormous G-forces and he was actually bleeding out orifices. And they cleaned him up before actually filming him again. He was quite shaken, quite sure he was going to die. That came as a real shock to me. Very, very interesting. Hey, listen, I'd love to go on with this fascinating topic, but just as a reminder for all the listeners, on our podcast page, we'll have links to all the stories mentioned, including Tanya's very excellent story, Wang Keqin and China's Revolution in Investigative Journalism, in The Guardian. I'd like to thank you all for joining me. Thanks very much, Jeremy, Bill, and of course, Tanya. And we'll see you all again very soon on the Seneca podcast. I'm Kaiser Guo in Beijing. Goodbye.